forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast. My guest today is John Scott. He's a partner at Anders CPAs and Advisors. We're going to talk about how to maximize your profits and minimize your taxes, which anyone in business of any size has to deal with this all the time. So welcome, John. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Richard. Wonderful to be here.
Yeah. Well, tell me a bit about what did your journey to become a CPA look like? You know, why do you do it? Let's go into some background first.
Sure. I started at a large local firm, which is the firm that I'm still at, Anders. And I did that in the early 90s, which is probably longer than some of your listeners were born. And we were very fortunate in that we got a lot of referrals from attorneys. And so almost all of our work came from other law firms and attorneys. And I was even more fortunate to meet a very entrepreneurial attorney early on who focused on data and what drove the profit and cash flow for his business. And he made his decisions based on that. And I watched him expand from just the St. Louis area from coast to coast, making data-driven decisions. And so that's kind of how I've modeled my advisory services for all other clients that I've worked on since then. I worked with him for about 17 years. He did make mistakes at times, but because he was paying attention to the data, he was able to course correct pretty quickly. And so I've gravitated towards working with lawyers and law firms to help them not focus on the historical that many accounting firms historically have done for clients. You know, they can very easily tell you what happened 3 months ago or last year, but we want to tell you what's going to happen based on current data. And we have to do that by having good financial records and reconciling on a cadence that's more than by the 15th of the next month. We want to reconcile cash on a weekly basis so that we know what kind of cash you have on hand. And then we want to be able to predict what that cash flow is going to be 12 weeks out and 12 months out. So we know where we're going. And this is pretty timely right now because Monday the 15th is the tax deadline. And if you're not going to get your return done, which many returns won't get done, you have to at least pay your taxes. So we're making lots of phone calls in this last week saying, hey, remember in December, we told you that the year looked like this. You were going to owe this much in April. It's time to pay it. So, you know, some people act surprised, but we did tell them and, you know, we're going to keep them on the in sync with their cash flow curve by paying their taxes on a currently basis. And of course, then leading to planning ideas to minimize those taxes.
Yeah, I mean, I use a kind of a handmade cash flow calendar that I made in Excel, but it's been an invaluable tool because, you know, sometimes you run close where, you know, there's not much reserves and you could see that, if I pay this bill this day, it's going to go into the red. So if I shift it a day or two, or if I break it up, I'll keep it green, you know, for the next month or two. And sometimes that's what's needed to keep yourself afloat.
Right. It motivates you to go out and pull those levers to increase cash flow. We like to advise clients that between 10 and 30% of their expected annual revenue should be their working capital, which is primarily cash. And cash can come from the owner put the money into the business, or it can come from line of credit or debt, which I don't really care for, or it can come from good billing hygiene and billing and collecting so you can build those cash reserves to keep it always in the green, to keep your spreadsheet positive.
And in terms of the CPA work, do you guys do bookkeeping or just CPA work?
You know, we're a full service CPA firm and we have a division that does virtual CFO services. I head up the division that does it for law firms, but we do it for all different types of businesses. And that division does three levels of service. It does transaction work where we'll pay your bills, record your receipts, and reconcile your books. That's it. No advisory services on top of that. Then there's a midline level of controllership where it's the transactional piece plus two meetings a month with either the business owner or the leadership team to go over cash flow, the forecast and pipeline, other things. And then the top end level is VCFO services where we do all those other things. Plus we meet 4 to 6 times a month with leadership to be part of the planning team. But we are a full service firm. We're in the heat of busy season right now. The initial deadline is Monday and you know, things are, it's never more efficient than 10 days before a deadline in an accounting firm.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The fact that you're doing this interview a few days before April 15th, that's a testimony, because 99% of CPAs would be like, oh, I'm way too busy. I can't even think until May, the middle of May, but yet you're here. So you've got to be organized. Otherwise, there's no way you could do it.
Well, we have a great team of people here, and that allows me to stay on top of things and leverage down my time. And that's another key factor that every business owner should look to, is try and find a way to leverage what you do. If you've got employees and there are things that you can push down, it allows you, once you train and trust the next generation of people, it allows you to go do bigger and better things. You're working on your business rather than in it.
Yeah. Why is it that, I mean, in my experience, most CPAs don't do any planning. It's like, you know, you call them, but it's tax time. All right, give me your receipts and all the other stuff. And, you know, they don't say anything to you throughout the year of, hey, you know, December 31st is coming. Is there any expenses you want to get in for this year? You know, do you want to plan and do this and that? And, you know, all right, we got to put salary away for you, you know, plus distributions. So you better do this. And it just doesn't seem like there's a lot of proactivity in the CPA world.
I totally agree with you. And I think many firms are truly just tax preparation businesses. They're historical in nature. They're looking backward. There's no planning. We're striving to bring this to an advisory level where we are pre-planning. We know where we're going. I like to tell a story about when our grandfathers took the family on vacation. The night before, he pulled out a 10-year-old atlas and he made some notes. And the next morning, he packed everyone in the station wagon and away they went. And the only thing he could do was react to what happened in front of him. If there was a major accident shutting down the highway, he didn't know till he got there. And he had to figure out a workaround. And then our parents had AAA triptychs, which was a little better because they knew in Atlanta there was construction. So there was a workaround already on the map. But today, with online banking and accounting systems and practice management systems for businesses, we have access to all this data. And it's just like using the Waze app or Google Maps. So when you take the trip, you're getting all this instantaneous data. And if you treat your financial statements like that, and so that you know at any one time what your cash position is, you can make those good decisions. And when some roadblock happens, you can make a quick decision to get back to your goals. And that's the advisory piece of what firms need to become and what we're trying to tell the world what advisory firms are.
Yeah, I know for myself, when there's very little money in the account, I get worried and it consumes me. And then when there's a bunch of money in the account, I feel like everything's going to be fine. But it's not good. It's like being addicted to drugs in a way, you know? You get these highs and lows. So how do you wean people off that, where, you know, they're not going to be so reactive to the balance and they're going to function with forethought?
Well, you know, if we set goals and we know that there are going to be peaks and valleys, I mean, our business is somewhat seasonal, although that it's not as seasonal as it used to be. But we know that in the first 17 weeks of the year, we do a third of our work and we're going to get a big influx of cash after this. We know that. And as long as we're on that forecasted path and we're not deviating from it, then I think having excess cash or going a little lean is okay, as long as that was the planned route. So I think the fact that when your cash gets low, it motivates you to go do things to replenish it, that's a good thing. It means you're entrepreneurial. I think you need to plan what to do with that cash to keep your business growing, and then it won't let you sit back and say, oh, I don't need to do anything right now. You need to always be thinking, okay, I've got excess cash. Where can I deploy it to grow my business, or where can I deploy it personally so that I don't just, you know, go to Disney World for a month?
Yeah, one thing I've seen is, you know, as I've been able to save some money, then I looked at, you know, the services that we buy, and some of them that I know we're going to use, we approached the companies, hey, can we buy a year up front? And that gave us like, you know, 10 to 12% discount on most of the vendors. So that helps. And then some of the large expenses that come up, I'm trying to find an automated way that money will get pulled from the account every day and put into like a reserve account, so you could build it up more slowly to pay for something instead of getting whacked with, you know, oh, you got to pay $5,000 for this. And it's like a big punch in the gut to your cash reserves, you know?
Yeah, I think that would be a great idea. Maybe you could talk to your bank about sweeping that into a money market account where you can actually earn some interest. But it's a great idea to then set aside some money for that anticipated big purchase, or, you know, whatever you're planning for. And then, of course, you should always plan for your retirement as well. So there's twofold reasons here. One is maximize your pension plan. That'll help minimize current taxes and save for the future. But the other thing is, if you build a brand and a business, there should be something when you're ready to retire and put your keys on the desk that you can sell. And you need to build a business that's not dependent upon your efforts and your name. You need to build something that can be passed on and anyone could come in, buy it from you, and run it successfully.
Yeah. And so, well, going backwards a little bit, you said with your clients at your medium and your high level, you meet with them a couple times a month up to like, you know, once a week or more, it sounds like. What's going on in these meetings when you do the consultative work? What types of things are you helping them look forward to?
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now back to the show.
You know, one meeting we will focus on the financial statements. That's usually the second meeting of the month. One meeting we'll focus on their capacity and pipeline. So if it's a service business and, you know, I have 10 people, but they're only 75% deployed, I do have 25% capacity. So I have to look at where do I get my work? What's in the pipeline? And I need a pipeline that's not the amount of my capacity. I have to look at, okay, of the new work I have in the pipeline, what's my close rate? So if I have capacity of $500,000 in a business and I close 50% of all my proposals, I need a pipeline that's at least $1 million in order to fill that gap in capacity. And if you think about it, when you can tell when firms or construction companies have capacity, because if you wanted to get your kitchen redone at home and you ask your friends for 3 referrals and you got 3 fabulous recommendations and they bid the project and 2 of them come in pretty stiff and 1 comes in slightly lower and more aggressive, I can tell you without looking that that aggressive firm has capacity. That contractor wants to keep his people busy and employed. He wants to pay the overhead and he's willing to take less profit to fill that capacity. Whereas the other 2 who were more consistently strong, they have a full plate. And so they'll take the work, but they're going to take it at the full profit that they want in order to accept that new work.
Okay, it makes sense. What do you notice in your business owners as you meet with them? They get on this schedule. How do they change and how they run their businesses according to your perspective?
Well, they're not used to getting current good financial data. And I think that's the refreshing part to them. Picked up a law firm a few months ago, and the only time they got good financial data for last year was sometime in January. And so what we're doing for them is giving them, at least on a monthly basis, accurate financial data. Eventually, we're going to get to a weekly basis where they know what their cash position is at all times and what we expected to be in the next 12 weeks. So it's eye-opening when you know where you're going and you know if you need to course correct to get to your goals. But there are many people out there, many business owners that think, if I just put my head down and do good work, good things will happen. And sometimes they do, but sometimes it's like turning the ship around in the harbor. It doesn't make, you know, an immediate 90-degree left or right turn. It takes time to turn things. So the quicker you can make a data-driven decision, the better you can get on course. Whereas if you're not paying attention to the data, it's going to be too late to achieve your goals if you make a change in the fall of the year.
Well, most people, and again, most CPAs, you know, will help them look back. Looking at the present is an improvement, but how far forward should businesses look? What do you counsel them to do?
Well, it depends on the business, but in a lot of our businesses, we do a rolling 12-week cash flow analysis forecast, and then we also try and predict out 12 months. So we want to know where do we want to go by the end of the year. And when we set a forecast, we don't just say, okay, we want to grow 20% and have no impact or degradation to net income. We have to stress test that. Do we have the capacity, the people to do that? Do we have the working capital here? So a lot of times people say, I want to grow 20%, but that might mean I have to go out and hire 2 new people, which in today's environment is extremely difficult. So when we stress test the forecast and when we do the cash forecast, we're looking at 12 weeks and 12 months, and it's on a rolling basis.
And what kinds of things do you see ahead that could be landmines or could be, you know, again, important points or things that would happen that, you know, need the business owner's attention and need to be addressed?
Well, it's going to be different for each business, but in a people service business where people are, let's say they're charging by the hour, then we have to set certain charge hour expectation for our employees. And we have to monitor that. We look at the pacing. If they're expected to charge 32 hours a week, but for a couple weeks in a row, they're only charging 20, either the work's not there or they're not being properly managed. So we monitor those charge hours or whatever value driver drives cash in a business. That's what we monitor. I did have a law firm who the owners hadn't taken any draws in 6 months. And we came in and we analyzed the charge hour expectation, compared that to the actual charge hours. And no one in the firm, including the two partners, were hitting their charge hour expectation. So once we pointed that out, the owners quit trying to figure out what was wrong with the business and they started working again and they started managing their people. And it took about 60 days for them to start charging enough time, sending out bills and turning that into cash, but they were able to start taking distributions again. So it really depends on what drives cash flow in your business and then paying attention to that to make sure that you're doing what's necessary to turn effort into cash.
Well, you mentioned law firms a number of times. Is that your specialty? That's most of your clients, or you just have several, so that's why you're saying?
You know, that's where I spend my focus. I have clients that are not law firms, but many of my clients are law firms. And on the VCFO side, that's what I work with specifically. But I have an entire tax practice that is businesses from manufacturing to architecture to real estate.
Okay. What are some of the specific challenges that law firms have in the, you know, in terms of their finances and everything? Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. It's really predicting cash flow. And I think we can really help them with that. The other thing is, and it's not just law firms, but attracting and retaining talent is extremely difficult in today's environment. It might be starting to turn a little bit, but almost everyone's staff is getting a call saying, hey, if you come over here, we'll give you a 25% pay increase. And it's tough for young people to not listen to that phone call. I would caution the young people not to necessarily jump at every opportunity, because at some point you have to stay where you are and take a stand and make a career. But if somebody's going to offer you a 25% pay increase, it's pretty tough to turn down. And then, of course, if we have to match that or try and match it, it's difficult. We either have to raise prices or it has to come out of the owner's pocket.
So what are some of the, again, besides attracting talent, are there any particulars specifically for law firms that they tend to have trouble with, either because of, you know, how they are, how they operate, just the unavoidable constraints to being a law firm, et cetera?
You know, I think the other thing that affects law firms are the ethical rules by which they must adhere to. And one of them is there are no legal non-competes in the law firm world. So if you and I were in a business together, let's say we were a beekeeping business, we could hold each other to a non-compete so that if we decided 6 months from now, hey, we really don't like each other anymore, we're going to go our separate ways, I'm going to buy you out, but that means you can't beekeep within 50 miles of this location for 2 years. Well, lawyers don't have, they're not able to hold themselves to those non-competes because they're unethical. So that's difficult. If there is a split between owners of a firm, they can just walk across the street, take their clients and set up shop.
Oh, so in the legal world, what, they're not allowed to do? What the state bars say that they're not allowed to have a non-compete with lawyers that work for them?
Right, because I think they view it as the client picks the attorney, not the firm. And so the attorney, if he leaves the firm, can take the client with him without compensating the firm. That's not the same in the accounting world. It's not the same in many businesses. You know, if you and I were in business together, we could certainly tie one another's hands. Whoever bought the other one out could say, I don't want you going across the street and competing against me.
Okay. Interesting. In terms of taxes, at what point in, you know, when someone has quote unquote enough revenue, do they need to start looking at various tax strategies? And, you know, how aggressive could and should people be? You know, let's talk about that dynamic. What goes on there? What's important?
Okay. With regard to aggressive, what I always tell clients is pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered. So I'm fine being aggressive as long as we have some area of the law to hang our hats on. Now, the first and foremost thing you should do when you start to become profitable is fund and maximize your contribution to your pension plan. And there are many options out there. You get a great tax deduction for it, and it's building assets for you going forward. Additionally, there are some great depreciation strategies for things that you're going to buy. I don't want, you know, I have clients who go, hey, I can go buy this big piece of equipment. I'm like, well, when do you need it? Well, we're going to need it 2 years from now. I'm like, why would we spend the money now to get a depreciation deduction or something that you could put in service, but you're really not going to fully utilize it till later? It happens a lot on vehicles where folks will go out and they'll buy a heavy SUV that's more than 6,000 pounds gross vehicle weight just because they want the write-off. And that doesn't make any sense to me. If you need the vehicle or you need the piece of equipment, then yes, you should go ahead and do it, and we can fully write it off within the rules and minimize your taxes. But you wouldn't want to spend money just to get the tax savings. The same thing goes for contributions. People will say, well, do I need to make some donations so that I can write those off? And my response is, do you want to support the organization? If you were going to make the contribution anyway, then yes, you should make the contribution, because every dollar that you give away could save you up to 40 cents, but you're still out those 60 cents. So don't just spend money to get a tax deduction. Let's spend money on things you need for the business to get that tax deduction.
How much work is involved in reducing taxes? Do you have to invest in, you know, multiple different tax shelters, or do, you know, one thing that saves 20 grand, one thing that saves 50, one thing that saves, you know, like, how do you whittle down a firm or a person that has a very large income?
Yeah, I don't particularly care for tax shelters, but there are things that do shelter income. Real estate investment is a good one. If your company is renting a building from an unrelated party, then, you know, one way to minimize your taxes and build wealth would be to buy the building or buy a building in which your business could reside and then pay the entity that owns that building, you, the rent. Now, it's got to be fair rent. You have to shop around and see what the fair square foot rental would be. But it is a good way to take an ordinary deduction out of your business and put it into an entity that owns the building. And we're going to shelter that with depreciation, interest, and real estate tax deductions. So you're getting a up to 40% deduction at your operating company, and we're probably not paying any current tax in the real estate entity because it's sheltered by depreciation, interest, and taxes.
Are there any tempting yet, you know, I wouldn't get involved in that kind of activities that you see the businesses and the firms you work with get tempted by or enticed by?
There are several things out there that are on the naughty list for the IRS, one of which is conservation easements. And conservation easements in and of themselves are written into the tax code. They are valid techniques. What the IRS has an issue with are these syndicated conservation easements that, you know, they'll have 400 acres in Florida that geologically has a lot of sandstone that could be mined, and they put it into this easement. They seek investors, and then they get a valuation for what would the property be worth if we mined it. They get a geologist to come out and put this study together, and all of a sudden, something that they paid $1 million for is worth $80 million. And then they take a vote and they decline to do it as a mine, and they give it to a conservatory, and they take a $79 million deduction. Well, that's the hogs get slaughtered piece of that phrase I told you earlier. It's just too aggressive. A conservation easement would work if your family, let's say they owned a piece of farmland, and all of a sudden the highway came through and you had one of the corners on the interchange that would be a great location for a truck stop. But you said, we don't ever want this to be developed. So you could then go out and get a valuation. If we sold this or developed a truck stop or commercial property on here, it would be worth X. And the difference between what we paid and what it would be worth at its highest and best use is a contribution. But we're gonna contribute this and forego the opportunity to ever develop it as a commercial property. That's a valid conservation easement. But the IRS is going after these syndicated easements. So the one where your family owns what is now on a valuable piece of interchange off the highway, that's okay. Taking it to the extreme where you could mine it, but you decide not to, that's the other extreme, and I wouldn't advise that. The other thing is captive insurance agencies.
Again, I was going to ask you about that chick, Sarah.
Yeah, So the insurance agencies, again, those are written into the tax code, and you have the ability to insure esoteric risk and gaps in coverage. So you can hire an actuary to say, basically, we've analyzed all their insurance policies and we can cover the deductibles and beyond the limits and any other risk areas that we think we can come up with. I've seen where the executives travel internationally, so they have an extra insurance piece for that. And the actuary comes up with a premium. The operating company pays the premium to their insurance company. So you get a deduction at the OpCo up to 40%. And then the insurance companies are C Corps, and they don't treat premiums as income, but the interest and dividends that are earned on those premium dollars is income to the C Corp. Additionally, once that premium expires, 12 months passes, that excess goes into surplus or retained earnings of the C Corp. So it's a valid technique. Where it gets a little gray and the IRS has gone after is when you set it up properly, you're in a risk pool, you're sharing with non-related people the risk. Where you get into trouble is if you see this big pot of money in your insurance company, and instead of investing it in the market, you go, hey, I'm going to borrow money from it. I'm going to take money that I've already taken this deduction for, not paid tax yet over here on the C Corp insurance company, and I'm going to buy real estate, and I'll have a loan between the insurance company, C Corp, and me. That's a no-go, and that's what gets people into trouble with those.
What about, I've seen this on a few, you know, financial statements where the owner will take a loan instead of compensation. They'll call the compensation a loan, and then it sits in the books for God knows how long, and, you know, it can amass to be a lot of money. You know, what happens with those kinds of things?
Yeah, I think upon audit, if there was no current payment of interest and updating of the note, maybe you didn't really have a note, the IRS would come in and say that that's a dividend in a C Corp situation, or in a flow-through entity like a partnership or S Corp, it's just compensation in the year that you took it. Let's get back to reasonable compensation. A lot of S Corps have, there is a bit of a tax advantage in that if you minimize salary and pay out distributions, you can save payroll taxes. But in reality, you have to pay a reasonable salary to the owner for whatever work they're doing. And reasonable means, what would I pay someone else to do that job? So I would analyze, if they're running the company, if that person wanted to retire, what would it take to hire somebody to do that job? That's a reasonable salary. But I see a lot of S Corps with, you know, a $25,000 salary, and then the S Corp's making $500,000. I think that's unreasonable. That's the hogs get slaughtered piece. Pigs get fat would be, okay, I could go out and pay $100,000 to pay someone to run this business. That's the salary I'm going to give the owner. And then the excess could be a distribution to the S Corp. The same thing happens in a C Corp. You would pay them what is reasonable for what they're doing. And then if you wanted to make excess distributions, you'd make them as dividends.
Okay. Any other don't do that's you're familiar with that are common?
I think the biggest thing is know where you're going and set aside money to pay taxes. Where people get into trouble, let's say I've got a flow-through entity and I'm making estimated tax payments personally, my safe harbor, which is either 110% of last year's federal or 90% of the current year tax, let's say for my example, it's $300,000, but this year is going to be better. So on a quarterly basis, the business is going to distribute 40% of net income by quarter to me. I'm going to pay my normal coupons so that at the end of the year, I'll have $300,000 paid in, but I owe $430,000 for the year. So there's extra $130,000. I've already distributed that to the business owner. They just have to be disciplined to put that in a money market so that when the balance due comes, April 15th, which is Monday, they have that money set aside to pay their taxes. And then, of course, I have to pay and distribute money for the first quarter of this year to help them pay their quarterly estimates as well. I think staying in sync with your cash flow is key to surviving and growing your business, because too many owners get that distribution of taxes and they spend it. And then I call them on Friday the 12th and I say, hey, on Monday, you owe $130,000. Remember, we talked about this. We gave you that money. They go, I don't have it. I'm like, well, that's where people get into trouble.
I see. What about payment plans? And, you know, once you're behind, I know it's a problem, but are the payment plans from the IRS easy to navigate, or are they pretty harsh, or what are they like?
I would rather you go to the bank and borrow, either borrowing your line of credit or borrowing your house and get it paid off. And then you have to be disciplined to not only pay that back, but stay current. Payment plans do work. I have had people that have worked through them, but they are painful. It's cheaper and easier to go to the bank if you can borrow that money. Wouldn't necessarily tell the bank why you're borrowing the money. I think you would need to, that might give them some pause if you said, I don't have the money to pay my taxes.
Yeah. No. What's changing in 2024? What appears that it may change that's really going to materially affect, you know, business owners that you see coming or is here?
You know, I don't know that the big changes are going to be in 2024. There'll be some small minor changes. But at the end of 25, the current tax law sunsets and we'll have some big changes. On the estate tax side, we're going to go from $13 million a person of lifetime exemption down to some number that's less than that. Could be as small as $7 million a person, which isn't going to affect a ton of people. But right now, there are very few people that are liable to pay estate tax. But if it rolls back to seven each, with the way the market has been over the last 40 years, there's going to be a lot of people pulled back into the estate tax arena. So I think, you know, we have to get people ready to do estate planning and funding of trust and making gifts. But we have a little bit of time for that. And then, of course, at some point, you know, interest rates are going to stay up. I know that the Fed is saying they're going to cut rates, but I don't know if that's going to be true. And taxes have to go up. We have spent so much money as a country we don't have. That's why we have inflation. I mean, when you create all this money that wasn't there before, prices go up. And because of that, and because of that debt load, taxes are going to go up at some point. They have to.
Right. And they could go up a little, a lot. I mean, who knows? What are people thinking?
And right now, we have a pretty good preference on long-term capital gains that hasn't always been there. I mean, the highest rates close to 40 and capital gains rates with the net investment tax are 23%. And so, you know, there were many years where there was no preference between those two. So that would be one way to raise a lot of revenue. But capital gains are an optional tax for people. They don't have to sell things to incur that tax. One thing that the Democrats have looked at is kind of the Canadian model for estate tax and say that there's an estate tax on death in order to get your step up. In, you know, let's say you had Anheuser-Busch stock that you paid a dollar for, or your great-grandfather paid a dollar for, and that's your basis. Well, if you would pass away, you get a step-up, but the step-up would go away under the A proposed model, where they would say there's a capital gains tax on death. In order to get that step-up, we're going to charge you some percentage on that step-up. So if the current AB InBev, I don't know what they trade at currently, but there would be a large gain in that holdings. You'd pay a lot of tax on that. Now, who that would hurt would be the family farms, because farm property has skyrocketed and it might have been in the family for years when they paid $100 an acre. And all of a sudden in Illinois and Iowa, it's worth $25,000 an acre. So it would be a burden to them to pay estate tax on something that they really can't convert to cash without selling to someone else.
Well, unfortunately, they'll probably be the people hard hit by it. But of course, the politicians will say it's, you know, to tax the rich. But I'm sure they'll, you know, their shotgun will blow off the heads of, you know, good people like them.
Those farmers are wealthy. They're just not cash wealthy. They're land wealthy. And they don't act like it, but it would be unfortunate for them to have to sell their property in order to pay an estate tax.
Okay. Well, very good. What's the best way for people to get in touch with you? You know, if they'll have this business need, like who would be a good client for you?
Good clients would be any business. Well, I'm going to focus on law firms. Any firm with three attorneys or billers, revenue between $1 million and $30 million. And the best way to reach me is my LinkedIn, John C. Scott, CPA. On there, I have a new book that's out called Judicial Dollars and Cents. And it talks about the financial side of running a law firm and how paying attention to data will help them maximize profit and cash flow and focus on serving clients by getting a good team in place to run those financials so that they can see key data points on a regular cadence to know, hey, the green and yellow are okay, red's what we need to pay attention to. Then they can stay focused on client service and then just spend their efforts on things that need their attention and paying attention to data.
What about smaller law firms, you know, solos, maybe one, two attorneys? Are you able to help them, or, you know, are the rates such that there's not much benefit you can give to them?
No, we can help them as well. It really depends on economies of scale. And the way we charge for our services is on the subscription model. So it's really a fixed fee price, and it's based on number of employees or billers. It's based on their revenue. So we go through a pricing spreadsheet that, based on the yes, no questions, how many cash accounts do they have? What's the volume of their accounts payable? That it prices it. And we do it on a weekly basis so that every week they're paying us. And it's a subscription-based model with no long-term commitment. So if we're 6 months into it and all of a sudden they find the greatest controller in the world they want to hire, they give us 30 days notice and we go away. We do think that we can be competitive with what they would, we can be competitively on an advantageous basis with what they could hire internally. And we bring a whole team of people to it. You have a VCFO or a controller, a senior accountant, a technology person that is servicing your account on a weekly basis. Whereas if you were going to hire that team internally, it would be cost prohibitive. Plus, you're taking your risk on hiring the right person.
Okay. Well, very good. Again, just to recap, where can people go? What's a website address or a place people can go to learn more about your firm and contact you?
Website is AnderCPA.com, AnderCPA.com. And LinkedIn is probably the best place to get a hold of me. It's John C. Scott, CPA. You'll see a picture of me with the Chiefs, Kansas City Chiefs flag. I know I'm from St. Louis, but I need a football team to root for, and the Chiefs are my team. So you can see me there. And there's a link to the book there as well.
Okay. Well, excellent. Well, John, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Richard. I enjoyed it.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at findinggeniuspodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.